Funding for Think comes from SMU Master and Doctor of Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Lauren Silverman, in for Chris Boyd. Maybe you've seen food or drinks labeled probiotics in the supermarket. The yogurt or kombucha things that supposedly boost immunity, clear your skin, help you lose weight. The claims are part publicity, but it turns out there is some science to back them up. See, what we eat does shape our microbiomes, and our microbiomes, they shape us. So what is a microbiome, and how does it connect to who we are and how we feel? Today on Think, I'm joined by Dr. Rob Knight. He's author of Follow Your Gut, The Enormous Impact of Tiny Microbes. Rob, welcome to Think.
Thanks, Lauren.
So let's start basic. What is a microbe?
A microbe is any organism that's too tiny to see. Typically, we're focused on the single-celled organisms in the gut. So we're talking about the bacteria, the yeast, and also some things you might not have heard of, like the archaea and so forth.
And how many of these might I have on me right now?
Well, that's a fascinating thing. As you mentioned earlier, they only make up about 3 pounds of your body, so about the same weight as your brain. But they can outnumber your human cells by as many as 10 to 1. So you can have about 100 trillion microbial cells in your gut and on the rest of your body, whereas you're only made up of about 10 trillion human cells. So by that measure, they're the vast majority, potentially. Obviously, there's huge error bars on these numbers, but they can be the majority of the cells that you're carrying around with you.
And it's not just what's on our skin. I mean, after a shower, how far down does that number go?
Not very far, although there hasn't actually been that much research on the specific effect of showering, but the vast majority of them are in your gut.
How about bathing in bleach?
Again, not so much research, and it's really hard to get that kind of thing approved by your ethics committee.
Yes, I would imagine. There's a metaphor that I like you use in the book. You say it's almost as though we've been trawling the ocean with a very wide mesh net and concluded that marine life consisted entirely of whales and giant squid. Now we're discovering that there's so much more out there on our own bodies, in our own bodies.
Thanks. So that's exactly right. We're just discovering that there's so many kinds of microbes that we can't grow in the lab, and the only way to understand them is to get out there and look at what they're doing in the wild, including the wilds within our own bodies.
And it's a pretty diverse ecosystem, right? Just like a jungle?
Absolutely. So just like a jungle, you're talking about hundreds of different species all interacting with one another. But then the species you have are totally different in different parts of your body. So what's in your gut is very different from what's in your mouth, what's on your skin. And then even within the skin, different parts of the body have tremendously different skin microbes. So what's in the palm of your hand is pretty different from what's on your elbow and what's on your foot. And similarly, along your gut, what's in your large intestine is very different from what's in the small intestine. So there's a tremendous amount of complexity to the life forms that live within us.
Why is it so diverse? Why might it be different? You even do an experiment, and you talk about it in the book. It's the keyboard experiment. You say what's on our left hand is actually different. The microbes on our left hand is different than the microbes on our right hand?
Well, that's a fascinating question. And the truth is that we just don't know what makes microbes so different one place to another and what makes them so different from one person to another. Human genetics plays a small role in it, but it's probably not important compared to some of the other things. So, for example, in the gut, which we know a lot more about than the skin in terms of its microbiology, your human genetics have a relatively small effect compared to your diet, which has a huge effect, at least over the long term, not so much over the short term.
So is our microbiome as unique as our fingerprints then?
That's an interesting question, but kind of on the fingerprint side, when we were trying to compare directly the likely utility of microbe evidence versus fingerprint evidence, we actually found it pretty difficult to get good statistics on how unique fingerprints actually are. But we were able to show that each person has a unique assemblage of microbes. Even identical twins have rather different microbial communities, although more similar to one another than non-identical twins, for example. So it's highly likely that your microbes are identifying. Being able to do a direct comparison to other kinds of forensic data turns out to be surprisingly hard, though, in part because good statistics on a lot of these other kinds of data don't exist.
So are we born with this ecosystem already established, or does it develop over time?
Our ecosystem develops over time in a very complex but ultimately predictable way. So it turns out that how we're born has a huge effect on our initial microbes. As I mentioned, in the adult body, the microbes in different parts of the body are very highly differentiated from one another. But in newborns, they're all basically the same. And it turns out that if you're delivered the regular way, all of the microbes all over your body look pretty much the same as the microbes in the birth canal of your mother. Hmm. Whereas in contrast, if you're delivered by C-section, the first microbes that you get, and again, this is all over your body, look pretty much like human skin, not like the vaginal microbial community at all. So those initial differences might be important for health. We're still trying to do additional research to find that out. But then the process of development from that to a microbiome that looks mostly like the adult state in the gut, that takes about 3 years. We don't really know how long it takes in other parts of the body. And then your microbiome continues to change through childhood, through adolescence, and even through adulthood into old age, although those changes are much smaller than the dramatic changes that take place in the first 3 years of life.
Now, you have a daughter, at least one you mentioned in the book, Amanda, and she was born via C-section. Did that concern you?
Amanda's my partner, actually.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
You have a daughter, though, right?
Yeah, we do have a daughter, and so she was born by C-section, which was not exactly what we were planning on. But you know, with babies, things frequently don't go according to plan, as any parent knows. And so that's exactly right. So we were concerned about that, and we made sure that we transferred to her the microbes that she would have got had she been born the regular way. I've heard from people affiliated with the Lecce League in New Zealand and Australia and in Canada to the effect that several groups have been recommending this practice for decades, although I couldn't find any written materials. No one's been able to supply them so far. So we think that this may be a practice that's been fairly widespread, although in a sort of word of mouth informal basis, rather than something that there's been a lot of research on. So one thing we're trying to do is to figure out in a more systematic way, and this has worked with Maria Gloria Dominguez Ballo, who's at NYU. We're trying to figure out in a more systematic way when you transfer those vaginal microbes initially, does that have positive effects on a baby's health?
Now, before you go on there, how do you transfer them? What did you do to transfer the microbes?
Well, we basically took some Q-tips. I mean, there's no research on how you should do this, right? At least not at the current time. So what we did is we took some Q-tips and essentially swabbed her mother and then swabbed the baby all over the body.
Just like it would have been if it were born the natural way.
Precisely.
And then are you using your daughter in some ways as a test? Do you test her microbiome, look at samples to see if it's how it's developing?
Well, we weren't doing this as an experiment. We were just doing this because based on the evidence available to us, we thought it was likely to be the best thing to do for her later on. So we were making that decision as parents rather than as researchers. But in the clinical trial that I described, what we're doing there is precisely tracking the babies over time, looking at how their microbiomes develop, and also looking at their health. Although at this point they're relatively young, so we don't have health outcomes yet.
Now, what happens when we live with people long enough, whether it's family or friends? Do we start to have similar microbiomes?
Yes, we do start to have similar microbiomes, and that's true whether you're living together with family or whether you're living together in a roommate kind of situation. We even have some preliminary and intriguing evidence that even sharing an office might cause your microbiomes to converge. And then Jess Green at the University of Oregon has done some very interesting work on roller derby, where people who join the same roller derby team even have their microbiomes converging to some extent. So what we don't know at the moment is which of these effects are large, which of them are small. Most of the research so far has just been focused on showing that there's some effect that's statistically significant. But being able to figure out which of those effects are big and which are little is still a very active area of investigation. And I should point out that it's not just your family members that you live with that you start to resemble, at least not just your human family members. So you also start to resemble your dog's microbiome as well, and vice versa.
Really? So I have two cats at home. If I were to do some tests, you're saying that their microbiome might look sort of similar to mine.
Well, we don't have a lot of data on cats. We try to enroll cat owners as
not
well as dog
people.
Owners. Well, we just had a lot less compliance. Okay. You know, people didn't return.
It's hard to herd cats, as from what I know.
Apparently so.
Yes. So, but you're saying that the pets really do also resemble. Is that just because we are not eating the same thing? So, how could that possibly happen?
We don't know anything about the mechanism. We just know that it happens at this point. But doing longitudinal studies to figure out how long it takes to equilibrate would obviously be really interesting. Of course, it's really hard to, it's really hard to do, say, a clinical trial on dog ownership. And coming up with a placebo would certainly be a challenge.
So take me on a little tour of the human microbiome. Let's just go into the gut. What is it that you see that I have no idea is going on there?
Well, some of the things that your gut microbiome is associated with that you probably had no idea that it would be involved with. There's a statistically significant effect of how much you drink, which you might have expected, how many hours of sleep you get a night, how much exercise you do, even whether you do that exercise indoors or outdoors. And also diet has a tremendous effect. Diet over the short term, you have to do something really extreme to see a significant change in the gut microbiome. So for example, Pete Turnbow at Harvard and his grad student Lawrence David did a study where they fed people a diet that was essentially all meat and cheese for 3 days. And that'll have a big effect on your gut microbiome, but most things won't. Whereas, in contrast, what you eat over the course of a year, and especially things like the amount of carbohydrates you eat, which has a big effect on Prevotella, the amount of leafy green vegetables you eat, which has a big effect on Oxalobacter, and so forth, that's what's really going to have a major impact over the long term. And one thing that we think is fascinating is that this responsiveness of the microbiome to long-term diet but not to short-term diet may in part explain why fad diets don't work. It could be that your microbiome is still very resilient over that period. So if you just do something for a couple of weeks and then stop, maybe it's just going to bounce back to exactly the same state it was initially. Whereas if you can do something over the longer term, you can shift your microbiome into a new configuration that's maybe going to help change things over a longer period.
I guess sticking with one of those diets can be pretty challenging for weeks, and then to have faith for years would be difficult.
That's exactly right, and weeks usually isn't long enough for a substantial impact on the microbiome, as a number of people have found in different studies. So in mice, it's amazing. Like in mice, you can just shift their microbiome around one day to the next by changing their diet. But unfortunately, it's a lot harder to do that in humans.
And most of these tests, I imagine, have gone on with mice, not humans.
That's right. The vast majority of tests have gone on with mice because you can precisely control their diet, and you can also do genetic manipulations on them, so you can really figure out how much is due to the host genotype and how much is due to the diet and how much is due to the microbiome, because you can raise them sterile in a bubble with no microbes of their own and then just spike in the microbes you think are important. And again, it would be incredibly difficult, not to mention unethical, to try to do that with humans.
We're talking today with Dr. Rob Knight. He's a professor of pediatrics and director of the Microbiome Initiative at the University of California, San Diego. He's also author of the new book, Follow Your Gut, The Enormous Impact of Tiny Microbes. Join our conversation by calling 800-933-5372 or by emailing think@kera.org. We'll be back with more from Rob Knight after a short break.
Thank you.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies, offering evening programs for a Master of Liberal Studies and the new Doctor of Liberal Studies degree. You can design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU this fall. More at smu.edu/GLS.
You're listening to Think on 90.1. I'm Lauren Silverman in today for Chris Boyd. Our guest is Dr. Rob Knight. He's director of the Microbiome Initiative at the University of California, San Diego, and author of the new book, Follow Your Gut, The Enormous Impact of Tiny Microbes. Rob, if the microbes that live on and in us outnumber human cells 10 to 1, do they influence how we behave?
Well, Aaron, again, that's a fascinating question. And I should clarify, it's as much as 10 to 1, not always 10
okay,
to 1.
Okay, fair enough.
So sometimes it's probably about the same number. Sometimes it might even be less. But there's probably some people where they're the considerable majority. So the answer to that is a definitive yes if you're a mouse. And evidence in humans is less clear at this point. So here's what we know about mice. Depending on what microbes they have, it can completely control their eating behavior. So there are some mice that become fat because of the microbes they have that make them eat too much rather than because they're better at extracting the energy. They affect stress. They affect anxiety. So, for example, there are genetically different mice where their behaviors have been thought to be due to the genetic differences between the mice. But if you swap the microbes, you swap how anxious they are, you swap how outgoing they are, and so forth. And so what's fascinating to consider is whether any of this applies to humans at the moment. Now, many of those experiments that I'm describing would be technically very challenging to do in humans. There's some evidence, although the evidence is not nearly as solid as the mouse evidence, but there is some evidence nonetheless that microbes in humans could be linked to depression, could be linked to autism, and could be linked to a number of other conditions that affect the brain. But that's again something where the evidence is accumulating very rapidly, and you always want to be a little bit careful in extrapolating from the mouse data that we have to humans too quickly.
How might microbes communicate with our brains?
Well, there's a lot of different ways. So just briefly, sometimes it's your neurotransmitters. So 90% of your body's serotonin is in your gut, not in your brain, for example.
Really?
Yes, and besides that, microbes can produce a whole lot of other different neurotransmitters as well. Sometimes it's direct neural signaling. So, for example, there's a probiotic that only makes mice happier if their vagus nerve is intact. So if you snip the vagus nerve, it has no effect whatsoever. So they can signal through the nervous system. There are small molecule metabolites that they can produce that get into the bloodstream and affect the brain. So in a mouse model of autism studied by Sakis Masmanian at Caltech, there's a molecule called 4-EPS where basically it gets into the bloodstream. It triggers a lot of the symptoms of the mouse model of autism. And then if you inject that chemical by itself, you get a lot of the same symptoms. So you can have that kind of signaling. Then finally, you can have signaling through the immune system and inflammation, where inflammation systemically is linked to depression and a number of other disorders. So the issue really is that there's too many ways they can do it rather than too few.
I see what you're saying. So it's not just, there's not one way.
Exactly. There's many different ways, and what we're trying to figure out now is which of those ways are really important, especially important in humans, and which of those ways are just something that can happen, but it doesn't happen very often.
Now, someone wrote in, Connie wants to know, how have changes in human culinary culture affected our microbiome? For example, transition from raw to cooked food, or from natural to purified water, or fresh to packaged foods?
So those are all great questions. One thing I should point out is that most of the technology to do this has only existed for the last 10 years or less, and most of the technology to do it cheaply has only existed for about the last 3 years. So the vast majority of studies that you'd want to see done could be done now. couldn't be done a few years ago. And so as a result, there's not much research yet. But that's part of what makes it so exciting for students who are getting into the field, right? So, for example, our PhD students, when they're in my lab, they often tell me that what's so great about working in this field is instead of having an incomprehensible molecular biology project along the lines of having to, say, tell their drunk uncle at Thanksgiving, yeah, my project is to take one acronym you've never heard of and see whether it binds to another acronym that you've never heard of, but it's really hard and it's going to take another 5 years, and yes, I'll still be in school all that time. You know, now they can say things like, yes, I'm trying to find out whether microbes make you fat, or whether if you eat raw or cooked foods, you're going to have different microbes in your gut, or that kind of thing. And so there's a lot of these very, very relatable, very important projects that are just out there to be done that no one's really investigated yet. So that's kind of a long way of saying we don't really know for those specific questions. A lot more of the research has been done on individual components of food. So, for example, things like the carbohydrate to protein balance, things like particular chemicals in food. So, for example, looking at inulin, resistant starch, other prebiotics, and so forth, or individual ingredients. But these are all great questions, and exactly the kind of thing that you can do now.
Do we know then whether something like a pack of saltines has a different kind of impact on your microbiome than yogurt? Do some foods change our microbiome more than others?
So we do know the answer to that, not because there's been any research done on saltines, but because yogurt has been of intense interest, as have other fermented foods. So what happens with yogurt is the lactobacillus and other butyrate producing strains. What they do is so essentially they're going to produce butyrate in your gut, and that's going to feed the cells that line your gut, make them healthier, reduce inflammation. Whereas you're not going to expect that from saltines specifically. Other carbohydrate rich foods tend to increase the amount of Prevotella, and
that's a strain of.
Prevotella is a genus of bacteria. It's a relatively diverse genus. And we see it in people who are living lifestyles that are thought to be relatively healthy with a lot of whole grains, but we also see it in people who eat a lot of pasta, eat a lot of sugar, and so forth. And so one of the things we're trying to find out, when we look at hunter-gatherers, they tend to not to have a lot of Prevotella, whereas farmers do tend to have a lot of it. And so figuring out whether whole grains are good because they increase it, or whether that increase can actually lead to other kinds of inflammation in the gut, is again something that people are trying to untangle at the moment. One of the things that makes it a bit complicated is, rather than having good or bad microbes, it's more like having microbes that can become weeds, where if they're in the wrong place or in the wrong amount, a microbe that could be very good in one context could be bad in another context. And so those are the kinds of relationships we're trying to unravel at the moment. And especially projects like American Gut are aimed at trying to figure out what is the diversity of different kinds of microbes we can have, and how does the same microbe affect different people.
Because it's also what the microbes, it's not just who's there, which microbes are there, but what they produce.
That's exactly right. And so for yogurt, one of the interesting things is that some of the microbes in yogurt tend to have their main effect not by changing the microbes that are in your gut, but by changing what they're doing as they pass through. And a lot of strains and microbes that are used in yogurt are specifically selected not to establish in your gut. And there's two reasons for that. One is that they want to keep selling you the yogurt every day rather than just once, right? But then the other reason is, from a regulatory perspective, if you say it's just passing through, then that's a lot less scary than if you say it's going to make a permanent change to your gut community.
And set up home.
Exactly.
Interesting. Patricia is calling from Flower Mound here. Patricia, are you there?
Yes, hi.
Hi.
The doctor mentioned how short-term changes in your diet doesn't produce that much results as much as a long-term change. I was wondering if that holds true for drugs as well. My teenage son was put on omeprazole a month ago for digestive issues. Do you have any opinion on that?
Thank you.
Sure. Well, first, I just want to clarify, I'm a PhD, not an MD, so none of this is going to be medical advice. It is true that antibiotics can have a large effect almost immediately, whereas there are other drugs that have relatively small cumulative effects, and other drugs where no association with the microbiome has been seen so far. So really, it depends a lot on the drug. One thing that's fascinating is that the same drug may target the same microbe in one person, but not target it in another person, even if that same microbe is there. So again, to get to a kind of individualized medicine that's based not on the human genome, where we're all 99.99% the same, but based on our microbiome, where we might only be 10% the same, is going to take a lot more research, because you essentially have to redo the study for each individual drug. And as I said, most of the techniques have only been available for a few years, so the vast majority of drugs have not been studied at all. The few that have been studied, so for example, ciprofloxacin has a very large effect on the microbiome essentially immediately, and with one dose, what happens is different people respond differently. So in a study with just three people, one person came back to their initial state more or less within a few weeks, a second person within a few months, then a third person was totally different a year after in terms of their microbiome follow-up. But then they all took another dose, and then they were all substantially different after that second dose. So so given what I'm telling you, that this is one drug in three people, it really gives you an idea of the scope of additional research that needs to be done for us to fully understand these effects, and especially their interaction with things like diet and with things like your own human genetics.
Is it fair to say we know what happens to our microbiome when we take antibiotics?
No.
No. Well, what do we know?
So we know that when we take antibiotics, it's going to have different effects on different people's microbiomes. It's even going to have different effects on the same microbe in different people, depending on whether that microbe is expanding its population, whether it's static, or whether the population's declining. So what we do know is that antibiotics have a tremendous ability to treat infectious disease, and tremendous ability to target the organisms that we're trying to get rid of that are pathogens that are making you sick. But what we don't know is the effects that they're having on all the beneficial organisms. There's emerging epidemiological evidence that suggests, for example, that if you have antibiotics early in life, you're much more likely to become obese later in life, obesity being one of those conditions that's linked to your microbiome. So Marty Blazer at NYU who's the author of the book Missing Microbes, which is a fantastic read, by the way, and you should definitely get it if you're interested in this topic. He's been involved in work that shows both epidemiologically in humans and experimentally in mice that antibiotics in early life can have a profound and permanent effect on your microbiome, and additionally on, for example, your weight later on.
How early on are you talking a few years or months or up to?
In humans, within the first 6 months. So basically, comparing people who got antibiotics within the first 6 months versus first after 6 months of age, and then again narrowing that window and doing more detailed studies is in progress at the moment by a lot of different groups.
So, if a course of antibiotics might actually change forever, permanently, the microbiomes that live in your body, it might not, I guess, return to normal.
That's correct, and that's been seen in some of the very limited number of people who have undergone such studies so far.
So, how can I increase the good bacteria and good microbes? Is there such thing as a good microbe? Do we know how to differentiate between them?
Well, there are definitely microbes that are more associated with good outcomes, and there's also clinical trial data for some of the probiotics that you mentioned, where if you're sick, like if you have irritable bowel syndrome, for example, if you have post-antibiotic diarrhea, there are particular probiotics that have been shown to be effective in clinical trials for those specific conditions. But it's kind of like drugs, right? You wouldn't ask in a blanket way, are chemicals good or bad? Hmm. It's all a specific drug for a specific condition, and you have to redo the trial for each drug and for each condition to see if it's effective there. And it shouldn't be that surprising that it's the same thing for microbes, which you can essentially treat as a very complicated chemical, although one that's able to reproduce itself. So in terms of encouraging good microbes, though, there are some general trends, although most of those trends are very unsurprising. And you don't necessarily need to know a lot about your microbiology to believe them. So, for example, eating a lot of leafy green vegetables is good. Eating a wide variety of brightly colored vegetables that have, carotenoids in the carrots, anthocyanins in the blueberries and so on, lycopenoids in the tomatoes and so on, that's good. Eating a lot of fries, you might be unsurprised to learn, is likely to give you a microbiome that's more associated with bad health. And so forth. But a lot of these are things that you can pick up just by doing experiments or by doing epidemiological work, looking at the diet directly. So far with the microbiome, we've been able to explain why some of these things happen in terms of the particular microbes involved. And what's going to be really exciting going forward is to find the more surprising things that we couldn't have guessed from those studies of diet alone.
So do you know, or has anyone done research on whether fruits or vegetables that have been, treated that aren't organic have different microbiomes of their own than the ones that are organic?
That's a good question. I haven't seen any research addressing that question directly. However, whether or not it's organic may have less an effect whether you're talking about the microbes that are on the plant itself or on the nutrient profile of the plant than other things like what soil it was grown in, what part of the country it was grown in, how much sunlight it got, and so forth. So all of those things have very large effects both on the nutrient balance and on the particular microbes that are involved. So to do the experiment right, you basically have to compare a lot of organic and non-organic versions of the crop that have been grown under a lot of different conditions, so you can really make sure that the relevant variable is whether it's organic or not, rather than say how long it was stored. Right, so for example, most apples have been in storage for over a year before they show up in the supermarket. And so that may have much more of an effect than how it was grown initially.
Oh, interesting. And those plants really do absorb or they're influenced by what they're grown in and as well in the region, not just their own genetics.
That's exactly right. And also, what exact variety of the plant it is. So the different cultivars can be very different in metabolite profile. We've been doing some work on that with Jaron van der Meyler at Penn State, where different kinds of potatoes have completely different metabolites in them that depend both on what kind of potato it is and on how you cook it. And so this applies both to beneficial compounds like vitamin C. So it turns out that fries are America's leading source of vitamin C. There's not much vitamin C in each fry, but people eat a ton of them. So it's true for beneficial compounds like vitamin C and also for harmful compounds like acrylamide that are produced during the frying process.
We're talking today with Rob Knight. He's author of the new book, Follow Your Gut, The Enormous Impact of Tiny Microbes. And if you want to join our conversation, you can do so by calling 800-933-5372. You can also email us. The address is fink@kera.org. Or you can send me a tweet. I'm @LSilverwoman. We'll be back with more from Rob Knight after a short break.
Funding for Think comes from the new SMU Doctor of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening doctoral program for Dallas community leaders and professionals. Now accepting applications for fall. More at smu.edu/DLS.
You're listening to Think on 90.1. I'm Lauren Silverman, in today for Chris Boyd. Our guest is Rob Knight. He's director of the Microbiome Initiative at the University of California, San Diego, and author of the new book, Follow Your Gut, The Enormous Impact of Tiny Microbes. You can join our conversation by calling 800-933-5372 or by emailing think@kera.org. Rob, what is the Human Microbiome Project?
The Human Microbiome Project, in the strict sense, was an NIH-funded project that ran from 2007 to 2012. And so what it consisted of was a mixture of an effort to characterize the microbiomes of healthy people, demonstration projects to link the microbiomes to disease, technology development projects, both on the lab side and on the computational side, a data analysis and coordination center to organize all that information, the trillions of bases of A's, T's, G's, and C's we collected, and then an ELSI component, an ethical, legal, social implications component, just like the Human Genome and other the Human Genome Project and other large-scale projects have done. And then in the broader sense, there are many human microbiome projects worldwide, including things like the large-scale MetaHit project, which is government-funded by the European Union, and crowdsourced efforts like the American Gut Project that I run, as well as many others on smaller scales.
So how do people send you samples?
In American Gut, specifically, so part of the issue with the HMP and similar efforts was that essentially it was impossible for people who were interested to get involved unless they met very specific criteria. So because the Human Microbiome Project was mainly focused around characterizing healthy subjects, people had to sign up. They had to be physically close to one of the clinical centers, so either they had to be at WashU or at Baylor, essentially. Then they had to be screened as healthy by a physician at every single site in the body. So essentially it was a study of 26-year-old medical students, if you look at the demographics, which on the one hand has a certain amount of interest to it, but on the other hand there's a lot of things that only happen to your microbiome as you get older. So opening it up for anyone to participate was really important. However, this was something that every funding agency that I approached about it absolutely hated. So in 2012, Jeff Leach approached me with the idea, couldn't we just crowdfund this and essentially have it supported by the participants? And so so the easiest way to find the site is just to go on Google and search for American Gut, which is the name of the project, American Gut. And that'll take you to the site that essentially shows you how you can sign up. It is donation supported, so unlike NPR where you donate at different levels, you might get a coffee cup or a tote bag or whatever. With American Gut, the perks that you're eligible to claim are more along the lines of things like different kinds of DNA sequencing. But essentially what happens is you sign up, you get your kit in the mail, you collect your sample, and we try to make that as low effort and as not disgusting as possible. Although I will admit that if you want to look at what's in your gut, there is going to be some poop involved, and then you mail it back in, and then that's integrated into the project results. So you get your own results, but you also get to see how you compare to thousands of people around the country and hundreds around the world.
So you're really analyzing people's fecal samples.
We really are, although you can also submit a sample from your dog, for example, or you can submit like an oral sample or a skin sample or many other parts of the body. When we were at Boulder, we did have to destroy one semen sample we got in the mail. Environmental health and safety was not okay with any further processing of that because it wasn't on our list of things we'd anticipated. But in general, anything from the skin or the hair or the mouth, as well as poop, if you're interested in it, we're interested in it.
Now, this may sound somewhat silly, but would you say that the comedy show Scrubs, it's about a group of doctors, had it right with this song about poop?
Everything comes down to poop.
Everything comes down to
cardiovascular
poop.
And lymphatic, yes, the nervous system too. All across the nation, we trust in defecation. Everything comes down to poop.
If you want to know what's wrong, don't sit and act so cool. Just be a man and eat some bread and drop the kids off at the pool.
Is that too silly of an analogy there?
It's not too silly an analogy, although the specific recommendation to eat bread makes it clear that you're getting your medical advice from a TV show rather than an actual physician.
Uh-huh. But in terms of analyzing and looking at the microbiome, this is the easiest way to do it.
It's the easiest way and the way there's most evidence for linking it to the health at the moment. Although there's very interesting studies shaping up to ask whether you could instead look at your spit or look at your skin and use that as a diagnostic indicator. So one of the fascinating things about your microbes is they have effects all over your body, not just at the site where they are right now. So the idea that you can read out a condition from your stool. has been demonstrated, even for things that you might have had no idea that the stool was a good readout for it, including things like diabetes and including things like rheumatoid arthritis, for example. So the potential that you might be able to read out from your mouth all kinds of conditions elsewhere in your body, as well as things like periodontitis and caries, which you can obviously read out from the oral microbes. There's a lot of interest there.
Russell is calling from Dallas. Russell, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Hey, what's your question?
Sure, Rob. Can you tell me, so, you know, probiotics are abundantly available at stores, and I'm wondering if there's any chance that probiotics can have any detrimental effects on certain strains within the microbiome?
That's an interesting question, and I'm from New Zealand originally, so very sensitive to issues about invasive species biology, because so many species that have been introduced into that landscape, whether it's possums or rabbits or deer or goats or sheep, have been a complete disaster. So the good news is, if that were true in your gut for the kinds of probiotics, like especially yogurt and other yogurt-derived strains and other derived strains from fermented foods, if that were true, a lot of people would be in a lot of trouble, and we probably would have seen those impacts already. Whereas so far, the preponderance of the evidence is that those fermented foods probably have a beneficial effect. So, for example, in a large epidemiological study published in the New England Journal of Medicine back in 2011, yogurt was the single food most tightly associated with weight loss, which is potentially potentially very interesting. So so it's possible that introducing probiotic strains has a deleterious effect, but there isn't a lot of evidence for it so far. And even the use of probiotics in immunocompromised people, like newborn infants in the ICU, and people who are on chemotherapy for bone marrow transplantation, for example, even in those populations, some probiotics have been effective for doing things like reducing rates of diarrhea, reducing GI disorders, and that kind of thing.
Now, William in North Richland Hills has an interesting question. He wrote in and says, during a colonoscopy, you can see clearly that the large intestine is clear of material. Does that mean that the biome, the microbiome, has to be reestablished, or is it hiding somewhere else?
So it's essentially hiding on the mucosa. So there's still that mucosal lining around your gut. It's got a fair number of bacteria in it, and while it's somewhat different from the bacteria in the lumen, say like the inside of the gut, probably there's enough of the luminal bacteria that come back relatively soon after. Although the question about after you drink the Go Lightly and do that bowel prep, how much?
You mean the lovely shakes that people enjoy so much?
Those lovely shakes that people enjoy so very much after they reach the age of having to do the routine colonoscopy, yes. So once you're eligible for those delightful shakes, understanding how much of an effect that procedure has is still something that we don't know a lot about. So I've heard of a number of people saying that they were going to do a study on it. I haven't seen them published in the literature yet, but I may just have missed it. Like, there's a huge explosion of publications coming out on the microbiome at the moment, in part because it's so much easier to do these studies than it was just a few years ago.
What do you hope to learn by studying the human microbiome so closely and getting samples as you are through the Gut Project?
Well, in the American Gut Project, we're hoping to figure out just what is the sheer diversity of kinds of microbiome configurations out there. How many different ways are there to be healthy, and how do people with different conditions differ from that healthy state? And ultimately, what we'd like to be able to do is not just take a snapshot, but allow you to take a movie of how your microbiome's changing as you do different things. So it's like the difference between just being able to post one photo on Instagram or whatever, versus being able to take a little movie as you're doing something that's exciting and likely to change it, like, say, going on a trip or taking a drug for the first time or changing your diet or that kind of thing. And so understanding how different individuals respond to the same kind of perturbation of the microbiome in different ways, I think, is going to be really exciting. We're also integrating the American Gut Project with the various clinically oriented projects that we're doing in the medical school at UCSD and at the hospitals associated with UCSD, as well as with a wide range of other collaborators around the country and around the world. So ultimately, the idea is that we'll be able to figure out what directions the microbiome can change in that are associated with better or worse health, better or worse outcomes. And we'd also like to be able to provide recommendations based not just on your genome, but on your microbiome, which has the vast majority of the genes associated with your body, be able to make recommendations about what drug you should take for maximum effect, figure out whether a treatment is working, figure out, say, before you go on one of those diets, are you going to be the person who loses 80 pounds or the person who actually gains 10 pounds against all expectations, which is exactly the sort of thing you'd want to know before changing your lifestyle radically, and all of those kinds of things.
Yes. Now, Candace wants to know whether nursing can restore healthy microbe populations in babies who've been given antibiotics. What is the effect of nursing on the microbes?
So breastfeeding has a number of positive effects on the microbes. There's several reasons for that. There's compounds in the breast milk itself that the human genome can't metabolize, but promote the growth of good kinds of microbes. There's also microbes that are transmitted with the breast milk directly, like there are beneficial microbes that live in the mammary glands. And additionally, there are antibodies that the mother passes on that help shape the microbial community in the infant. So there's some evidence that breastfeeding after antibiotics has a beneficial effect, but most of the studies done to date have been done with relatively small numbers of children, and figuring it out on a larger scale is going to be really important. One thing that's a little difficult to disentangle is, especially in the developing world where many of these studies are done, if you're breastfeeding, you're also not feeding infants formula that's been mixed up with potentially dirty water. So being able to separate the effect of the positive effect of breastfeeding from the effect of avoiding transmitting bad bacteria in the water is still something that's a very active area of research.
Yeah, that's a little bit difficult, as all of this, to disentangle. How far away, how many years do you think it's going to take until we understand better just how diverse the microbiome is in people and begin to unravel some of these mysteries?
Well, we're understanding it better and better every year. And some of the mysteries, like, for example, which microbes in the gut respond to red meat and are more likely to contribute to atherosclerosis, for example, which Stan Hazen and his colleagues at the Cleveland Clinic worked out just a couple of years ago, and which particular bacteria degrade digoxin, which is a very commonly used heart drug, which was worked out by Pete Turnbull and his group and out at UCSF. Again, very recently. There's a lot of these individual pieces of the puzzle that are starting to be filled in. So we know more every year, and we're not going to have to fully understand it in order to make a lot of progress. So I think a good analogy is the nutritional deficiencies that were a huge disaster a century ago, say like pellagra in the south of the US, for example. Rickets was a huge problem. Goiter was a huge problem in places like Minnesota and Switzerland and New Zealand, other places with volcanic or glacial soils, not much iodine. And all of those problems, you know, we still don't understand nutrition. And if you run a potato through the mass spec, you'll find all kinds of compounds where we have no idea what they do or even what they are. But that doesn't mean that, say, fortifying milk with vitamin D, fortifying bread with B-complex vitamins and so on, fortifying salt with iodine haven't been tremendous public health successes. So I think in the same way, we're not going to need to fully understand the microbiome in order to be able to do diagnostics and potentially do equally important things that have a measurable and potentially large public health impact based on the microbiome.
But what do you do to get people more comfortable with the idea? If you're going to fortify, say, milk with some bacteria, people just have that gut reaction, no pun intended, to that idea.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because when you're looking for yogurt at the supermarket, do you look for the one that says everything
live
in here is
cultures,
dead, or do you look for the live cultures, right? So there's certainly precedent for getting people excited about the idea that their food is alive. And so I think the way to go is to sort of transfer that positive experience that people are having from yogurt to other foods that could also benefit from being alive when they're consumed.
Our guest today is Rob Knight. He's author of Follow Your Gut, The Enormous Impact of Tiny Microbes. Rob, thanks again for being with us.
Thanks so much, Lauren.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker, engineered by Shelley Knavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. And you can contact us via email, think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Lauren Silverman. Thanks for listening and have a great day.